On this glorious celebration of Sri Janmashtami, the appearance of Krishna in this world, I'll read from Vishnu Sahasranama, which describes the qualities, the activities, the glories, the attributes by which Vishnu is to be known as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. We are, after all, celebrating Krishna's birthday because he is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. There are millions, billions of people, different living entities, born at every moment and dying at every moment. So why celebrate Krishna's appearance day, especially as from our very limited perspective in time, it seems like a long time ago. Although actually in terms of eternal time, there's no such thing as a long time ago. So why celebrate Krishna? Well, because he's God. Well, what makes him God? Anyone can say, I'm God. In fact, there are a lot of people going around who say they're God or allow others to say that they're God, but they don't have the qualities which make them the Supreme Lord. Those qualities are summarized in a verse which Srila Prabhupada often quoted, the definition of Bhagavan: Aishvaryasya samagrasya viryasya yashasya shriya jnana vairagya yoschaiva shandang bhagaitingana. He who possesses in full opulence, power, fame, beauty, knowledge, and renunciation should be known as Bhagavan. Or Srila Prabhupada liked to use the term Supreme Personality of Godhead. So he has unlimited qualities, and some of them are mentioned in the names which are given here in Sri Vishnu Sahasranam. So we're celebrating Krishna's birthday because he's God. Is that right? Well, in Vrindavan, they celebrate because he's the son of Nanda Maharaj. Nanda Maharaj had a son after a long time. They didn't think he's God. And in fact, they never thought he's God, even when there was all evidence to show that he is God. And that's another facet of him being the Supreme Lord, is that he shows it to those who want to see him as the Supreme Lord, and he hides it, he hides the fact that he's the Supreme Lord from those who don't want to see, which includes the worst rascals, and ordinary rascals also, and the topmost devotees. From our perspective, we are to accept him as the Supreme Lord, and then we can develop from there, as stated by Krishna himself in Bhagavad Gita, Aham sarvasya prabhavo matas sarvang pravartate. Everything comes from me. And then again, he says it in another way, just to hammer the point home. From me everything emanates. Iti matva, understanding this, accepting this, bhajante mam, they worship me. Who? Buddha, intelligent people. Bhava samanvita, being overwhelmed by feelings for Krishna. So, I'll go on with this Vishnu Sahasranama. Name 365 is Bhikshara, which is similar to a better known name, or has the same meaning as a better known name, a more commonly used name, Akshara, which has other meanings also. Kshara means the end. In the alphabet, Sanskrit alphabet, it begins with A and ends with Ksha. So Ksha is at the end. So the sound of Ksha is called Kshara. So Akshara, Vikshara means no end. Never waning, never declining, never ending. So Krishna is never declining, never wanes. That word is usually used in relation to the moon, which gradually fades away. Now the moon is in the middle of the waning stage. Krishna appeared in the dark fortnight, the waning fortnight of the moon. He appeared in the dynasty of the moon. So the moon, being very happy, shone in full glory. So he never wanes. He never declines, unlike everyone else who's powerful. There are many people who are powerful. God is powerful. That's in this world, people are very interested in power and dominating others. They mostly think of God as being very powerful, but although that is the conception or the understanding also of Krishna, especially among the Gaudiya Vaishnavas, his power is not emphasized. Gaudiya Vaishnavas and others also, the Pushti Margis, they also emphasize the sweetness of Krishna. Yeah, so we emphasize more the sweetness, the beauty, the charm, the pastimes. But for those who are very interested in power, they may see someone as very powerful, as being the greatest. But their power is limited in scope and limited by time. Seems to be the most powerful person of the 20th century was Adolf Hitler. But his power was never complete. He didn't conquer all the places that he wanted to conquer. And he wasn't in full control of Germany, even. People plotting to kill him. And naturally, he died. But Krishna's always in complete control, everywhere. And his power never wanes. But apart from that, his beauty never wanes. Whoever is very beautiful, they must know that anyway, their beauty is only skin deep. And it won't last. The tragedy of youth. The beautiful woman is destined to see her beauty wane. The wane means gradually decline. It's a heartbreaking process that, oh, for the first time notices a little line on the face. Oh, no. And then it grows, and then more come. And then however much you put cream and powder and vitamin E and all these kind of things, gradually the lines come and the beauty goes. But that never happens with Krishna. He never becomes old. Unlike the paintings of that Sistine Chapel of Michelangelo, a painting of God, very old, because he's the oldest person. It just goes to show that even though he was this Michelangelo, and around him, that many people were, they also were considered genii, great minds which shaped Western civilization, shaped it on so many misconceptions. For instance, that God is old, so he must look very old and have a long beard. But Krishna is Advaitam Achyutamanadim Ananta Rupam Adyam Purana Purusham Navayovanam Cha. He is one, the one and only person who is infallible, Advaitam Achyutam Anadi. There's no source of him. He appears in unlimited forms. He is the source, he is the beginning. He is the oldest person, but he still always as appears as a fresh youth because he's not under the control of time. So his beauty never fades. His glory and majesty never fades. He's always supreme. Even if he poses himself as less than supreme in becoming the darling child of Mother Yashoda, but he's always supreme. There's no competition for the job. He's not in danger of being knocked off his position. Unlike a mundane ruler, he's never in fear of his subordinates, that they'll gang up on him and take over his position, assassinate him. There's no question. His sweetness never wanes. In fact, not only does it not wane, but it waxes. The opposite of waning in relation to the moon is waxing. It increases. Although Krishna's glory, fame, beauty, power, knowledge, sweetness, pastimes, associates, and everything else about him is unlimited. His mercy, his kindness, but it's also increasing. Always increasing, as there was a name which we just read, that Riddha means always increasing. Baladev Vidyabhushan, in his commentary, commentary on Vishnu Sahasranama, he gives many interpretations of names specifically of Krishna in his Vrindavan pastimes. His explanation of this name, Vikshara, is that he's always affectionate to those who take shelter of him. It doesn't specifically apply to Vrindavan pastimes, but it indicates that those who take shelter of him, they won't be neglected by Krishna, nor will Krishna's affection fade away. We sometimes find that we're friendly with someone and then it just kind of dies out after some time. But with Krishna, it's not going to be like that. It's not that sometimes we see someone becomes very friendly with us to take advantage of us, and then when they've got what they wanted, they drop us. And Krishna's not like that. Krishna, even if someone is rejected by everyone else, if accepted by Krishna, Krishna will accept him forever. Never reject him. And Krishna doesn't care whether others like him or don't like him or consider him high class or low class or whatever. There are many such instances of, for instance, in the pastimes of Lord Rama with the Chandala king Guha, he fully accepted the hospitality. Shabari, who was also from an outcast community, he accepted food, even eaten already by her. He accepted monkeys as servants, he accepted vultures as servants, and in this way he showed that his affection is in response to affection, not in response to worldly position. We see that people, they like to be photoed in the company of some notable person. So in India, you'll find sometimes people have in their house the picture of their father or grandfather standing next to Indira Gandhi or some other big personality. In America, you'll find sometimes in people's houses, they're standing next to the president or something like that. The president or an ex-president of America. Cost them $5,000 at least to have that photo taken. And it's just one photo, that's all. They get their photo taken, they can put it in their house as if to show that they're an intimate friend of the president who's just raising funds for his next presidential campaign. But Krishna's not like that. He, once he's with you, he's always with you. In fact, he is always with us, but we're separated from him by our rejection of him. But his love for us never fades, even though there's so much grounds for it to fade. Imagine if someone, you're trying to be friendly with them and they just ignored you and sometimes spoke badly of you. And this went on and on and on. Sometimes you just think, just forget it. What does it matter? Just leave them. But Krishna doesn't think like that. He remains with the conditioned soul, birth after birth. He listens to all the nonsense, and they speak, and they may even blaspheme Krishna and act in most atrocious ways. But Krishna's always waiting, always waiting. You know, whenever you're ready, I'm ready. Savadhaman parityaja mame kam sharanam braja aham tva sarva papebhyo mokshayishyami ma shucha. Krishna's willing. If at any point we say, all right, Krishna, now I fully surrender to you. I'm giving up all other ideas. I have nothing else but you now. Krishna says, okay, all right, whatever you did in the past, just forget it. I'm taking away all the sinful reactions. Don't worry. That's Krishna. Who can imagine how affectionate he is? It's easy to be affectionate to those who reciprocate with us. But to be affectionate to those who don't reciprocate with us, that we can hardly imagine. We become annoyed, especially if we're trying to be affectionate to someone and they don't reciprocate. Or there are many cases of people who are trying to be nice to others, but who only get nastiness in return. And it's very difficult to maintain any good feeling towards such a person. But Krishna does. That's one of his great qualities. Our name 366 is Rohita, which means reddish. So certain parts of Krishna's body are red. It's described like the inner part of a lotus. Certain lotus flowers is reddish. So certain parts of Krishna's body are reddish. Also the soles of his feet, the palms of his hand, naturally his lips are reddish. That wouldn't be a pale red like most of us. Women, sometimes they put on strong red lipstick, but Krishna's, he doesn't have to put on lipstick. He has a ruddy complexion. When he gets angry, his eyes will get red also. Bhishma Dev wanted to see Krishna angry. There's also a species of fish called Rohit, and Shankaracharya, taking this cue, refers to the Matsya avatar, the fish form of the Lord. He appeared as a fish when the universe was deluged. So that was a very suitable form to appear in the form of a fish at that time. One of the commentators, taking the root ru for Rohita, says it means to grow, to increase, to rise, to reach. One who expresses himself, or one who causes all beings to express themselves is rohita. So that he to grow, well, that was certainly true in the case of Matsya avatar. In the Krishna, he grew a little fast, but more or less in the manner of humans. He was a baby, became a child, became a youth, but then he didn't grow anymore. But that was more or less in the manner of humans. Though a little fast, because when he was young, at 8 years old, he was already more developed than that. But some forms of the Lord, they specifically grow quite extraordinarily, particularly Vamandeva and also Matsya Avatar. He appeared in the hands of Satyavrata when he went to pick some water from the water. Oh, there's a little fish. And the fish asked, protect me from the bigger fish. So he took him home and then over and put him in some goldfish bowl or something like that. And then he already, overnight, he grew to be too big for the bowl. So he's put in a pond and that became too big. He's put in a lake and he grew to be as big as the lake. Then he had to go to the sea, the massive sea, at the time of inundation. So he really grows. He expresses himself. Well, Krishna certainly expresses himself. There's this idea in modern life, you have to express yourself, let yourself be heard. Don't keep things inside. Let it come out. Show your creative potential. You should let it be known who you are in the depths of your being. And all this kind of thing. Well, Krishna certainly expresses himself. He expresses himself by the whole creation. We can see the mountains are like his bones, and the rivers are like his veins. The birds and the birds and their singing expresses his musical traits, the rainbow, those who can see God everywhere. What about seeing God in the tsunami, the hurricane? That's also an expression of his character. So he expresses himself through the creation. He also directly expresses himself by teaching Bhagavad Gita. Everything, all things wise and wonderful, all creatures great and small. What is that? All things bright and beautiful, all creatures great and small. All things wise and wonderful, the good Lord made them all. So when we hear any beautiful music, we can think that is Krishna. Not that we're going to go to a concert of music, just some music playing, or and different people may have different ideas of what is beautiful. But naturally we come across such things and we think, this ability has come from Krishna. This Mozart was practically from the time he could talk, he was composing music that just would come in his mind. And his problem was to write it down quickly enough, because just a whole symphony would come in his mind. That's coming from Krishna. All ability comes from Krishna. So he expresses himself and he causes all beings to express themselves. He is the Supreme Person, and the feature of personality comes from him. The atheists, they want to depersonalize everything. Now, although they admit that we don't really know what's going on in the brain, but we're just beginning to discover something. So they have this theory that personality is just a feature of the brain. So there's all these chemicals in the brain. So according to them, There's no such thing actually as personality. There's no such thing as a person. A person, what you call a person, is a bunch of chemicals that got formed by evolutionary processes into a body. And what we call our personality is that which is generated within the brain. And there's nothing more to it than that. And whether you like it or not, that's just the fact. So they say. Well, good luck to them. They'll find out that when they get separated from their body and their brain, they will continue to exist, and their future, immediate future, is not going to be very relishable. If there were better scientists, they would take note of the studies of which have been performed, which, as well as can be understood by scientific methods, because you can't touch, taste, feel, smell, or hear the soul in the way that you can empirically study the gross elements of this world, but as scientifically as, for instance, studying or determining the existence of Higgs boson, actually it's Krishna's boson if it's there at all, it can be deduced that reincarnation is a fact. There's good evidence of that, but they're not scientific enough, really scientific enough, to take cognizance of that. The fact that there is good scientific evidence that reincarnation is a fact, but they want to reduce personality to a non-entity. According to them, there's no such thing as personality. Hare Krishna. Name 367 is Marga, which means a road or a path or a way. Our Lord Jesus is said to have said in the Epistle of John, the last one, it's supposed to be the most important statement of his of all, but somehow somehow the three prior gospel writers didn't write it. He is said to have said that, "I am the way, the truth, and the light, and no one comes to the Lord except through me." Which, if you don't know that, you can just go on the streets of Belfast, and pretty good chance a Christian will come and tell you, especially if you're dressed as a Hare Krishna, as they call us. They'll come and tell you, "It's only through Jesus." Well, we can say it's only through Krishna. And you say, "Well, it's in the Bible." We'll say, "Well, it's in the Vedas." And then, you have to believe the Bible. You have to believe the Vedas. Anyway, they have their own theology. Krishna is the way to everything that is auspicious and desirable. Everyone wants that which is good for them. And how to get that? The demoniac way of thinking is, well, I have to arrange it myself, which means I have to exploit others, or control others, or trick others, or avoid others if they're more powerful than me, and get what I want. The whole of life should be aimed at getting what we want. But we don't really know what we want. That's a big problem, isn't it? If we don't know what we want, or what we should want, what we should desire. The child may see some brightly colored liquid in a clear glass bottle and think, "Wow, that looks nice, I'd like to drink that." And the mother snatches it away, and the child bawls, "No, I want to drink it." And the mother says, no, no, no. Because the child wants to drink, but he doesn't know that's some cleaning liquid which is meant for cleaning the toilet or something, and it will have a very adverse effect on the health of the child. So that is our position in this world. We want that which is not good for us. But that which is actually desirable is Krishna. We should want Krishna. Krishna is he who should be sought after. We should go along the path that is Krishna. He is the way. He's the way to what? To himself. He gives his instructions, which are none different from him. So let us go on the path to Krishna. Go back home, back to Godhead. Let me just see what Baladev says. With Rohit. I didn't explain Baladev Vidya. But anyway, I'll finish Marg. Baladev Vidyabhushan says that his devotees are always inspired by his ever-fresh transcendental qualities, such as those described in Vishnu Sahasranama. And thus, his devotees always search for him. Where is Krishna? Where is Krishna? And he reveals the path to them by which he can come to them. So in this way, he's Marga. Rohit means, one meaning Baladev Vidyabhushan has given is that he becomes angry, red-eyed, at those who try to harm devotees who take shelter in him. So in this way, he's seen as Rohit. Bhishma was very happy to see Krishna attack him, being angry. He wanted to see Krishna in that mood. That is a glorious mood of Krishna. Krishna lost his temper because Bhishma was attacking Arjuna in such a manner that Arjuna would have to be killed unless Krishna defended him. So Bhishma exulted in seeing Krishna's love for his devotee, Arjuna, expressed as fierce anger toward another devotee, namely Bhishma himself. So of course Krishna is the way to everything. If we want to go to hell, then Krishna also helps us. He gives facility. whatever we want, it's only Krishna who will facilitate that. So it's intelligent to understand what is actually desirable for ourselves. Similar name 368, similar in many ways, is Hetu, which means the cause. Actually, this word has many meanings in Sanskrit, such as motive, reason, purpose, logic. I'll go through cause here, although there are other names which means cause also. Karana, that's a common word for cause, which will come up just after a few names. So I'll just go through cause, because many of these names or many of these synonyms are discussed under other names of Vishnu Sahasranama. So this cause, that he is the cause, this is very important in philosophy. There are two kinds of philosophy. One is speculative philosophy, in which they try to find out the cause. Much of science is concerned with finding out the cause. Why is it like this? Why, applying the question why, and then we try to find out. But Vedic philosophy is different, that we hear from authorities, which is actually a much better way. For instance, just by seeing a frog and then scientifically trying to speculate how the frog came, who would ever think that it came from a tadpole? Or seeing a butterfly, who would ever think that it came from a caterpillar? This is, considering this, it's a major flaw in theories such as the Big Bang theory of the origin of the universe. We see, or at least they tell us that they see, according to what the astronomers see from the vantage point of this tiny little planet, with their actually not so very powerful telescopes, although they're much more powerful than they used to be, using their very limited minds and intelligence, stuck in some particular point in time, they have concluded from what they observe that the universe is expanding. So they presume that, well, it must have all started from some point, and it must have been a big explosion and it exploded. But there's no evidence of that. It's just a speculation. They don't know. They presume it must have been like that. It seems logical, but much in nature that we see, we couldn't have imagined that it would be like that. If we see humans are, or mammals in general, are born from the wombs of their mothers, we could never imagine that birds and many reptiles are, and some insects are born from eggs, and one mammal, platypus, they're born from eggs. Why should that be? Why should it be? That's another question, but another type of question. But the point here is that simply observing an effect, in many cases, that will give us no clue as to its immediate cause. So, any such theory, Big Bang theory of the origin of the universe, it just presumes that the universe, as we presume it to be expanding, of course there are some scientists who say that, well, we don't think it's expanding. You look through the same telescopes, and what you see and interpret is different to what we, how we interpret it, although we see the same thing. But even if we accept that the universe is expanding, it's not necessarily true that it's always been expanding like that, or that it the cause of its expansion must have been a Big Bang. And it seems even less likely that there could have been infinite mass in an infinitesimal space. That's another part of the Big Bang theory. And then why it should bang. I mean, there's so many problems with the Big Bang theory from the logical point of view. But there's an answer to that. It's called singularity, which means it only happened once. And why is it like that? Well, we don't know, but we're working on it. I saw a video of one student asking a professor, it's one of the phone in and ask the professor, one student, you have to introduce, I'm studying physics at such and such a university, and my question is, what was there before the Big Bang? And the professor answers, well, we don't know, and we probably never will know, but we're working on it. And science, it's called science. Very authoritative. So what is the cause? The cause is Krishna. That's not scientific. Well, actually, if we take it as a hypothesis that there is a cause, there's the cause, both, just like in Vedic philosophy, the example is often given, Sankhya philosophy. What is the cause of the pot? Well, one cause is the clay. Can't have pot without a clay. Of course, nowadays you can have, well, even in those days, you could have gold pots and silver pots, but generally, for everyday use, clay pots. So one cause is the clay. That's the material cause. And another cause is the potter, because the clay is formed into a pot by the potter. So Krishna is both the nimittakaran, the instrumental cause, and the upadan, or the efficient cause. These are the technical terms used. There may be other causes also. Why did the potter make the pot? Well, to support his family. And how is he supporting his family by making the pot? Because people want pots for various things. So there may be many causes. Why did Krishna create? Krishna created the universe out, but he's also the efficient cause, because the universe, the ingredients also come from him. The ingredients of the universe. And then other causes are the desires of the jivas to be separate from Krishna. Krishna is the ultimate cause. Those who don't accept that there is a transcendent cause, they're called demons. Transcendent means, this word became very popular in the 1960s in the Western world, with transcendental meditation. Transcendent means to go beyond and above, or to be beyond and above. So a transcendental cause. In other words, that this universe is caused by something which is beyond it, which is very reasonable. That there is, that the cause is something which is beyond and above and more powerful than the effect. The chapati is cooked by the housewife, so the housewife is on a higher platform than the chapati. The universe comes into being via an agency which is on a different platform, beyond and above that of the universe. Those who don't accept this, they are called atheists, demons. Asatyam apratishtam te jagad ahur anishvaram aparaspara sambhutam kimanyat kama haitukam. Haitukam, that's derived from the word hetu. So the demons say that this world, it's not real. That's the Mayavadis will say that. Apratishtam, it has no basis. There's no controller of the universe. Then what's it doing here? How did it come into being? Aparaspara sambhutam. It came into being just by some mutual interaction of elements. How about that? This idea that the universe simply comes into being without any particular cause is not something dreamed up recently by people who call themselves scientists. Krishna spoke about this 5,000 years ago. He spoke about it millions of years ago to the sun god. There are always atheists in the world. We're in the world to forget Krishna. Some people remember Krishna thinking that, well, it's a good idea to remember him somewhat so we can get some facilities for enjoying this world separately from him. And others think we don't need to remember him. We'll make our own facilities to enjoy separately from him. They're called atheists. So it's nothing new. They say the new atheists. You've got all this new scientific knowledge, and just like the Big Bang, it's very scientific. There was nothing and it exploded, and then there was everything. And it all settled into place, and here we all are to talk about it. Although it's highly unlikely, in fact it's so unlikely that it's by the science of statistics, it's unlikely to the realm of super impossibility, but we're here and there's definitely no God. So it's called the anthropic principle, which means we're here and we're damn well here and you better believe it and there's no God. That's scientific. So it's nothing new. There have always been such foolish rascals in the world who present themselves as being very intelligent. Those who have fully realized they see him everywhere. Yomam pashyati sarvatra sarvam cha mayi pashyati tasyaham na pranashyami sachame na pranashyati. Krishna says that those who see me everywhere and everything in me, for them I am never lost, and I am never lost to them. So those who are theistic fully, they see Krishna everywhere, and the demon can't see Krishna anywhere. They can't see the ultimate cause anywhere. They have a need to deny that ultimate cause, because if they accept that he exists, then their own notions of being themselves, Ishvaro Ham Aham Bhogi, the supreme controller and the supreme enjoyer, then that's shattered. Then they have to accept that they're under control and they have to submit to him. They have some responsibility to him. So atheism, it's not so much about being, it's not a matter of being intelligent or scientific. It's an attitude. And for that matter, so is theism. By studying and trying to understand through our brain who is God or that there is God, that doesn't constitute theism. It's more an attitude, the tendency to accept or to not accept. Now we should, as Shastra and the Acharyas have, we should try to understand intelligently, not just, well, do you think there's God? Well, yeah, maybe. And the next day, oh, I banged my head on the door. They can't. If there was God, that wouldn't have happened. He wouldn't have let it happen. No, there's no God. And then I was walking down the road and I found $100 bill. Oh, there must be God. So it's not what we feel like that decides whether there's God or not. Actually, the question of whether there's God or not, it's not for us to decide. Reality is as it is. Does Ireland exist? Well, you can say, oh, I don't believe Ireland exists. Well, you can believe or not believe, but the fact that it exists, or if it is a fact that it doesn't exist, it doesn't depend on what we think. The reality is independent of our opinion of it. So, Does God exist or not? And you go on arguing all day and night, all your life and life after life. His existence is a fact. Or, if you want to be an atheist, which we don't, then his non-existence is a fact. But it doesn't depend on what we think. We are not the arbiters of reality. Reality is as it is. Vishnu Sahasranama is a description of the reality of Krishna. So he is the cause of everything. How do we find out that cause? Well, first of all, that there is a cause. There are still a few scientists who are more or less rejected by the orthodox scientific community who insist that there is no Big Bang. The universe is just the way it is, and it's been like that forever, and it'll go on like that forever. So they're also atheists, because they see there's no cause, but there's no need of explaining any cause, either theistic or atheistic. It's just the universe is, and it was, and it will be. How are we to understand all these things? How are we to understand? How can we be so presumptuous as to think that we can, just using our little brains, understand such big questions? So we understand from Shastra. We understand from Shastra. It's quite, yeah, if we take as a hypothesis that there is an intelligent designer and creator behind everything, we'll find that everything that we observe in the universe fits very nicely into that hypothesis. Whereas if we hypothesize that there's no ultimate direction, everything becomes very confused. So it's actually much, even from the point of view of if we actually did discuss what science should be instead of what those who call them scientists have appropriated the meaning of science to be, then actually theism should be accepted at least as an excellent hypothesis by scientists. But the whole scientific endeavor of trying to understand by our own endeavor is from the outset flawed, because we can never understand much simply by our, even by the collective endeavors of the human race over several hundred years. We may have discovered so many things, but it's still only a tiny drop of knowledge, and it's only from one perspective. There are so many facets of reality. All of reality is not explained simply by physics, mathematics, chemistry, biology, and all these kind of things. That's only one aspect of reality. So, our whole process is quite different. We understand from Shastra. That Krishna is Sarva Karana Karanam. Everything we see, it has a cause. If we look at that cause is also the effect of something else. And if we look at the cause that is the effect of that cause, then we find that also has a cause. So if we go back, we'll find Sarva Karana Karanam, the ultimate cause is Krishna. Now, the atheists, they postulate that, well, even if you say there's God, then someone must have caused God. So then they go on for this infinite regress, which isn't logical. So the ultimate cause we accept from Shastra is Krishna. So he's the cause of everything. He's also the cause of bondage in this material world. He's one of the cause is the desire of the living beings, but Krishna effects that. And he's also the cause of liberation from it. He's also the cause of the realization of himself by those who want to realize him. He is the cause of bliss for his devotees. In this way, he inspires great love in the hearts of his devotees. He's the cause of this. What is the cause of love? And the scientists will say, yes, it's some evolutionary thing that has arisen to help perpetuate the species. Although we don't find that dogs and cats love each other. I mean, they may have some friendship, but male-female love, it doesn't exist between dogs and cats. Between some species, some birds, the male bird and the female bird, they live together throughout their life. But the dog, they just catch a female and that's it, and then let her go. The male dog has nothing to do with the female having impregnated her. Now, what is the cause of that? They'll say that's for the species to continue to exist. But then if it's all just chemicals, where in the chemicals comes the desire to maintain the species? And why should a bunch of chemicals desire to, that more chemicals should form themselves in similar forms? And this is a major lacuna in evolutionary theory, which seems that the theists who are arguing, the atheists themselves, they never thought of it. It seems like the theists who are arguing, they don't ask this question either. This atheist-theist debate which is going on. They never, where does that, you say that the all this defensive mechanisms, mating mechanisms, it comes from a desire for the species, that the species continue to exist. But where does that desire come from? Why should a set of chemicals that's formed by evolutionary processes, so they say, into the form of a dog, desire that after that dog form dies and then dust thou art and unto dust thou shalt become, the chemicals merge into the rest of the chemicals everywhere else, that set of chemicals which we call a dog are desires that more sets of chemicals in the forms of dogs should be produced. Where does that desire come from? What for? But that would be a problem for the Christians also, because according to them, only humans have souls. So if we say that it comes from the soul, the desire, then they have a problem with that, because then clearly the soul is in the body of a dog also, which they don't want to accept. So Krishna, he is the cause. Not that he's doing anything. The potter makes the pot. But Krishna, simply by his desire, everything happens. Simply by natasya karyam karanam cha vidyate natat samas chabhyadikas cha drishyate parasya shakti vividhaiva shuyate swabhavaki jnana bala kriyacha. He's not obligated to do any work. There's no one equal to him or greater than him. He has innumerable energies by which everything is affected. That is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He's the ultimate cause of everything. He's the cause of bliss for the devotees. In so many, everything about him causes bliss in the devotees. Thinking of him, touching him, seeing him, his form, his qualities, His prasadam, his smell, his dress, his abode, everything about him causes bliss in the devotees and causes more envy in the non-devotees. Therefore, we don't discuss the qualities of Krishna among non-devotees because they simply become more and more demoniac by hearing that. They become so angry that they want to kill Krishna and kill the devotee, or at least blaspheme. So Krishna is the ultimate cause of everything. Just for that matter, saying that what is the cause? We don't see the cause in the effect. Well, if we take this body, we are told that this body is constituted of oxygen, hydrogen, nitrogen, carbon. But would you ever guess if you saw a piece of coal, which is carbon? It's largely constituted of carbon. Would you think, well, that's the kind of thing that's a major constituent of this body? How could we know? It's not obvious. So this name, Hetu, the cause, is a very important name. There are several names in this section which are coming up of Vishnu Sahasranama: Ishvara, Karta, Udbhava. This name, Hetu, is very much related to all these names or similar or synonyms of them. So the next name, 369, Damodara. That's more we could say is a Vrindavan name. It's connected with the pastime of Mother Yashoda tying up rope around his stomach. Dara means rope, dori in modern Bengali. It's not used so much, other words are used. Dama, his stomach. So that's one meaning, a well-known meaning, that he allowed Mother Yashoda to tie his waist with a rope. Another meaning is that he has all the world in his stomach. Everything's in his stomach. We see that he lies down as Mahavishnu, then the lotus comes up from his navel. And all the worlds, the world is produced from that, from Garbhodakshay Vishnu. So the world is in his stomach. Dama. Oh yeah, Udara. Udara means stomach. And here Dama means rope. No, I got mixed up. So not Dara. Dori is a word in Bengali for rope. But Dama here means rope. It means the worlds. It means happiness. So, and Udara means stomach. So he has a rope around his stomach. He has the world in his stomach. He has happiness in his stomach. Well, everything about him is happy. After a good meal, not today. For Krishna, yes. Not for us. So, satisfied stomach. Krishna feels very happy eating all the nice preparations offered to him by his devotees. That name will also come. Amitashana. unlimited eater, big eater. Ah. Yeah, let's see. That he allows himself to be tied up by a rope by his mother, that also that gives rise to understanding other qualities of his, other names of his, just like the word, the next name is Saha, so that will be described in relation to this also. So in, all these names are interconnected. They know. Oh. Oh, here's a meaning given by Shankaracharya. This is an important one, another important. Dhamma also means control. Shamo dhamma tapashocham. So self-control. So he who is known through a mind which is purified by means of self-control and other such qualities. So if one is not self-controlled, one cannot understand Krishna. So that's an important meaning. That the mind has to be purified by means of self-control. Of course, we say ultimately bhakti, but bhakti subsumes. There's no question of bhakti, of at least of pure devotion, unless we endeavor to control the mind, which means in controlling our activities, controlling our senses, and then Krishna reveals himself. Atah Shri Krishna Namadi Nabhavad Grahyam Indriyai Sivon Mukhe Hi Jivado Swayameva Spurati Adaha. Krishna cannot be known through the mundane senses, but he reveals himself to persons. Krishna, what is that? Swayameva Spurati Adaha. He reveals himself to persons of purified consciousness who engage all their senses in his service, willingly, happily. So that requires a controlled mind, because if we will think that why should I cook this for Krishna? I'll cook it for myself. Why should I serve Krishna? Why should I work for Krishna's happiness? I work for my own happiness. So it requires self-control in Krishna consciousness to offer all our activities to Krishna. One of the commentators, Radhakrishna Shastri, says that one meaning of the name is that the whole universe is within him. And another meaning is that he's tied up by a rope and controlled by his devotee. So this goes to show the apparently contradictory nature of the Lord, of how he is so powerful, yet he is so subservient to his devotees. So that shows the great quality of bhakti, which Krishna accepts. So powerful that Mother Yashoda, who is tying him up, she's also inside him, because everything's inside him. She saw, when she looked in his mouth and saw the universe, she also saw herself within him, looking in his mouth. Krishna is so great, but a major feature of his greatness is that he makes himself available to his devotees. Mm-hmm. Then the next name, 370, is saha, which is interpreted as sahate iti saha, sahana. Sahana means tolerance, sahishnuta, trinadapi sahishnuta. Trinadapi sunichena torar api sahishnuta. So this all connected words means tolerance, patience. For instance, although he's the Supreme Lord, he tolerated being tied up by Yashoda. He could have said to Yashoda, look, this is enough. You should understand, actually, I'm just playing as God. I'm just playing as your child, but actually I'm God. So enough of this. You've gone too far now. You should understand your position. I'm God. So none of this tying me up and all this kind of thing. I mean, what am I going to say when I go in the court in Vaikuntha and they see me tied up? They'll never accept this. But Krishna, no. He accepts very happily to be tied up. Even though he doesn't have to be. Is that a fact? Krishna doesn't have to be tied. God doesn't have to be tied up. But he has to be because he's the son of Mother Yashoda. And he's a naughty boy. And she's tied him up. So by her bhakti, she tied him up. He becomes even though he's so powerful, he becomes subservient to the love of his devotees. He's very tolerant. There are so many examples. His devotees, even if they do something wrong, apichet sudara charo bhajate mamananya bhak sadhureva samantavya samyak vyavasito hisaha. Even if one is actually a dedicated devotee, if he does something very wrong, he should still be considered a devotee. That doesn't mean he goes on doing things wrong. Kshipram bhavati dharmaatma. He will quickly come to the proper position, but some lapse on his part is not to be taken very seriously, Krishna says. For the non-devotee, if he does something very wrong, he has to suffer for that. But for the devotee, he doesn't have to suffer. This should not be misinterpreted or misused. But Krishna is willing to pardon lapses on the part of his devotee. And someone who regularly commits sinful activities cannot be considered a devotee. But if someone, due to bad habits or whatever, slips, Krishna doesn't hold that against him. So he's very tolerant of that. He's very tolerant. He bears the burden of the universe. Of course, for Krishna, it doesn't seem like a great burden. Not a burden in the sense of strength. Krishna has enough strength to uphold it, but to uphold the situation in which so many jivas are inimical to him, and still he gives them facility and doesn't just annihilate them and obliterate them. He gives them all kinds of facilities to operate within this world. That is an example of his great patience and tolerance, that he's just waiting for them to turn to him. Even maybe one in a few million or trillion years, Krishna has time. He's not in any hurry. He's not. He doesn't become hopeless. You know, it's quite hopeful. Yeah, sometime, they should turn to me. And even if they don't, he's still very patient toward them. Another example that in Croatia and here also I've been hearing from Manida Prabhu a few times recently is that of Shishupal. Krishna is very tolerant of him. Normally a kshatriya, if he hears someone insult him, he won't tolerate even once. But Krishna tolerated 100 times Shishupal insulting Krishna. And Shishupal was very expert in insulting others. He practiced on others, and he saved the perfection of his art of insulting others for Krishna. And he started practicing young. As the first words that he spoke was blasphemy of Krishna as a baby. Mostly the parents, they're waiting. What will the child say? Will it be Papa or Mama? What will the child? First words, Krishna, rascal. The first words of Shishupal, very deeply ingrained in his rascalish mentality. He was born with three eyes and four arms, and the first sound he made was not like a baby screaming, but he brayed like an ass. So his mother, Shuta Shrava, she was, what is this creature we've given birth to? So she and her husband, Damagosh, they were ready, let's do a Moses with him, just abandon him, just leave him somewhere. And maybe he'll die, maybe he'll live, but we don't need a child like this. But then some ghostly kind of figure appeared and said, no, don't kill him, he'll be a very powerful king. You don't worry about that. And this extra eye and extra arms will go away. But he'll go away when he is seated on the lap of the person who will kill him, who is already born. So many people used to come to see this strange child. And the mother would put so many kings, powerful people. Who's going to kill others? It's only Kshatriyas who kill others. So many came, and she would put the child on the lap of all these Kshatriyas, and he just remained in the same grotesque form. Of course, Lord Shiva has three eyes and Vishnu has four arms, but they look very dignified and saintly. But this Shishupal is something horrible looking. One day Krishna and Balaram also came to visit, and Shuta Shrava set the baby on Krishna's arms, in which immediately the extra eye and the extra two arms vanished. So then she knew, this boy will kill my boy. So she begged Krishna, please, I beg you, please don't kill him. Krishna said, well, I will kill him, but not immediately. I will tolerate, he can insult me. Even 100 times he can insult me. After that, if he insults me anymore, I'll kill him. So Shishupal, his worst insulting came at the Raja Surya Yajna, where in front of everyone, he started berating Krishna. Of course, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, as he generally does in such instances in the Bhagavatam, explains that Shishupal's tirad, although it was definitely meant to vilify Krishna, could be understood in another way as praising Krishna. Just like when Shishupal said that, you see, first of all, he started off as he was seen as the son of a Vaishya. Now he says he's the son of a Kshatriya, and you can't understand what kind of background he's coming from, because in Vedic culture, you don't do things like that. You don't go from being a Vaishya to a Kshatriya, and to not know what someone's caste is means you are persona non grata, because everyone has to have some position. So it's meant as an insult. But Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur explains that actually what he was saying was quite true. No one can know who Krishna is. He doesn't belong to any caste of this world. So in this way, Saraswati inspired Shishupal to speak in a manner which actually praised Krishna, if it's understood from that perspective. But it was meant as blasphemy, and Krishna cut his head off, cut Shishupal's head off. But he was very tolerant, 100 times he tolerated. And he tolerates we are forgetting Krishna. We are inimical toward Krishna. Krishna tolerates. Of course, through the material energy, some punishment is there, but it's like a slap to wake us up. Come on, come out of this world. Don't remain here. Jeev jago, jeeva jago, gaur chandra vave. Krishna, even though people, they ignore him and they blaspheme him, they behave in ways which are quite demoniac, Krishna, he arranges for them to be punished as his want, as is suitable through the material energy, but personally he tolerates and just waits for them to come to the proper position. Saha also means with. So Krishna is with everyone. With everyone and with everything. And if he wasn't, which is unimaginable, then we wouldn't exist. Nothing would exist. He is the basis of existence because he is with everything. This Higgs boson, they call it the God particle because it's supposed to be with every other particle and make it exist. But it's Krishna. Krishna is the person who makes everything exist. What makes the God particle exist? So-called God particles. Krishna. He's with everything. Shall I continue? Or you all want to go and chant some rounds? I've spoken now for almost 1.5 hours, which is beyond. We're just talking about tolerance, most people's tolerance level, both for the mind and for the body, to sit like that. Well, I didn't hear anyone saying, let's go on, so I suppose you're being polite and you want a break. Okay, we'll take a break. Yeah. You can ask a question. The Lord's Rohit, anger towards his devotees? No, he's not angry towards his devotees, except if, well, in Bhishma case, that was exceptional. But generally, he's not angry toward his devotees. Yeah, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is angry at Advaita Acharya, but that's unusual. That's unusual. Generally, he's angry at the non-devotees, not at the devotees. He was angry at Advaita because Advaita wanted to present himself as a servant of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was treating him as his superior. So Advaita acted as a non-devotee. And then Chaitanya Mahaprabhu became angry at him. And then Advaita thought, that's very nice. So that was something unusual. If Krishna is God, just if.
And that's the utterance of fame. And somebody might say that, I think there's lots of people more famous, like Nelson Mandela.
There are more people more famous than Krishna, like Nelson Mandela. As well, John Lennon got in a lot of trouble, if you remember. You maybe weren't born then. For saying that now we're more popular, talking about the Beatles, than Jesus. We're better known than Jesus. And in Britain, people didn't care much because they don't care much for Jesus. But in America, they caused a big uproar. And he had to say, well, I didn't really mean it. Nelson Mandela, maybe he's better known than Krishna. But there are a lot of people in India who know about Krishna and never heard of Nelson Mandela. Nelson Mandela won't be known, maybe after 20 years or 30 years, people. Just like John Lennon. How many people have heard of John Lennon? In Ireland, yes. In Norway, not in the young generation, so I'm told. Even here. Yeah, China be happy and say, you know, that was, we sold maybe millions of books. I personally sold many thousands of books by saying, you've heard of George Harrison, haven't you? Yes. Everyone knew. And then we'd show the Krishna book with George Harrison. Practically the book was sold already. Well, we had to do a little work also. But we're better known than Jesus, John Lennon said. We're more popular, he said. But that was, maybe that was true in Britain. It wasn't true in other places, but it's only for a very short time. And Krishna is known, Yang Brahma Varunendra Rudra Maratostun Vanti Divyai Stavai, all the demigods, they're praising Krishna. It's stated in Bhagavatam that even though Krishna is so, has so many wonderful transcendental qualities, and all the demigods are praising him, but the miserable people of Kali Yuga do not like to praise him. So that's a symptom of Kali Yuga. We tend to think of this particular time and place and circumstance that we're in as the sum total of reality. But it's just a blip in time on one tiny little planet. So the fact that maybe in the Western world people know Nelson. Well, yeah, probably in the Western world, Nelson. But I tell you, if you go in the street, a lot of people never heard of Nelson Mandela. They'll tell you the name of some football star or something. A lot of people, that's all they read in the newspaper. In fact, there are newspapers which don't, they hardly have any news, because a lot of people are not interested in it. I don't know in Northern Ireland, but we have in Britain the Sun and the Daily Mirror. They don't give any news, actually. It's just, or if it's news, it's news about film stars and football players, which actress is running around with which footballer. So it may be that a lot of people, they know. I mean, they do surveys, like go in the United States and ask people, can you think of a name of a country beginning with the letter U? And you see people thinking, They can't think of one. And then the person says, well, what about the United States? The person's been a citizen of the United States for all his life, and he couldn't think of the name of a country beginning with U. So, as Herr Einstein said, that two things are unlimited. One is the universe, and the other is human stupidity. And I'm not sure about the first one. So, they may have heard of Mandela, they may not. But if they don't know about Krishna, what are you doing about it? You have to do something to let them know. Let's turn the question around. Let them know about Krishna. If we don't know in this lifetime, we're going to know in some lifetime. Although in some lifetime, only people in this lifetime may hear of Nelson Mandela. But in future, people won't know. But at some point in time, everyone will come to know of Krishna. Indirectly, we all know about Krishna. So he's the most famous. And if among the renegades of this planet at the present time, Krishna is not so well known, that doesn't mean that Krishna, that's the measure of how well known he is. Yeah, anything else? Yes, please. The expression of Jesus Christ, I am the way, the light, and the truth, and no one comes to the Lord except through me, attributed to Jesus by John, although we don't know if he actually said it or not, because if it's such a significant statement, why didn't the other epistle writers who wrote before him include it? And there are a lot of things in John like that. But even if it's true, excuse me, so from what I'm told, I'm not a student of Aramaic or Old Greek. It's written in the present tense, or whatever that means. It means it's something which is, it's written in a tense which is applicable to that particular time. Just like if I say, I am sitting on this seat here. It doesn't mean that if I say, applicable to this body, I am English. It's half true. I am English, Irish. Okay, all right. So that's true throughout my life. But if I say I'm sitting on this seat, that's only true for the next few minutes. So apparently, this statement, I am the way and the truth and life, no man comes to the Lord except through me, was written in that tense. It means right now, right here. And clearly it's not true for all time. I mean, this is one of the reasons why in my childhood, I started thinking that there are some serious problems with what they taught us about Christianity, because, and that phenomenon is going on all over the Western world, that people being exposed to other cultural expressions of religion, some of which are much predate Christ, and then they think, well, why only through Christ? I mean, is it? Was everyone in India who was dedicated to God before Christ, they didn't know anything about him? They had such a developed culture of theism, and it's only through Jesus. Jesus popped up in Palestine, and all of a sudden, everything anyone had ever said and done or about God became nullified. So, if we are to accept God as being the what in modern terms we call the broad-minded person that we hope he would be, then why only through Jesus? It doesn't seem to make any... Only through Jesus. And everyone else who dedicated their life to God has to burn in hell forever because they didn't accept Jesus. What's your question, by the way? Explain to Christians. Christians of that ilk are non-explainable to. They... You can explain, but they won't listen. If at all they're prepared to listen, they would already understand that there is some other way except Jesus. Otherwise, why would they listen to you? They already came to that understanding themselves. So, practically you don't have to explain it. Yeah, you want to say something?
No, I just come from a generation where most of the devotees are fascinated, of course, with Christianity and Jesus and the religion, like Hansa Tutta was one of them. And he developed actually a very firm approach.
Was Hansa the one who brought out the Aquarian Gospel? Was it he who made a big thing of that? When I was in England and he was the GBC, we always used to hear about this Aquarian Gospel. I wonder if it was coming from him. Prithu also.
Actually, what he meant, but Prabhupada actually stressed that point. He didn't follow him. Hmm. And he said, yes, for you, yeah. And then they shocked, they couldn't argue more, because he agreed. Hmm. Yes, yes, for you, Jesus is the only way. Yes, yes, we agree. And they were like, because I expect in the Kanishtha, you know, agitation, they expect that you will attack them, and that, no, Jesus, Krishna only. And but he said, no, yeah. It was like a dead-end road. He parked him like in a dead-end road. He couldn't...
Oh, that's a good way. If you say Jesus is the way, the truth, and life, you can just agree with them. And they'll be so astonished, they won't know what to say after that.
Yeah, for you, yeah, just
So yeah, then Prabhupada would say, then you should follow him. Do what he says. Thou shalt not kill. That was Prabhupada's standard line for Christians. Thou shalt not kill. And your whole culture is based on killing. Killing, 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 killing. Killing culture. I often thought that if Jesus would have known what they would do in his name, that he would have just remained as a carpenter and not preached all these things. But it happens to everyone. Who knows what they're going to do, or what they're already doing in Prabhupada's name, and they did in Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's name. And what they're doing in Prabhupada's name, we can only expect it to get worse, because when things start to get bad, they tend to get worse and worse and worse. It's only a matter of time before they have the Bhaktivedanta abortion clinic. All over Andhra Pradesh, you have things like Saptagiri wine shop, Balaji hatcheries, which means chicken farm. So it's just a matter of time. We have a hospital, and then the government will say you can't refuse abortions, and then they'll justify it. Just a matter of time. So, with that somber note, we'll end this session. Anything else you want to say about the way, the truth, and the light? Janava was a great preacher. So you can also become the way, the truth, and the light. Yeah, all right, you're... Hare Krishna. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Shri Shri Radha Govinda ki jai. Shri Krishna Janmashtami ki jai.